Radio.
Guinness and God presents Dr. Deirdre Little, speaking on the topic, Embryo Quality Checks, Creating the Children We Want. Guinness and God is brought to you by the Catholic Life Archdiocesan team of the Archdiocese of Canberra and Goulburn.
I'd just like to start by saying that in 1553, the paediatric textbook of the time, there was probably only one, began with a promise on the front page. And that promise was written by Thomas Fair, and it said, "Our purpose is here to do them good that have most need, that is to save children, and to share the remedies that God has created for the good of man." When I was a medical student learning paediatrics at Sydney Uni, that same quote appeared in the front of the paediatric surgical text as a promise. 400 years later, nothing had changed in our motivation and our intentions. But over the next 40 years, a lot has changed. Promises and medical oaths have disintegrated, deteriorated into statements of ambience and fellow feeling, but with no substance and no light. We've had the alarming situation in 2007 where the Medical Journal Australia published an article which was researching Down syndrome prevalence in Queensland. And they were looking to evaluate screening programs and to see how effective they had been. So they compared the rates of live Down syndrome births in rural Queensland and in metropolitan areas. And they found to their horror that the live rate of Down syndrome births had actually gone down in that southeastern corner of Queensland. And that was particularly in private obstetricians' hands. However, when you moved out of that southeastern corner, the rate was either static or had actually gone up slightly in rural public hospitals. Now, there was outrage over this. Outrage. The screening program wasn't working in some areas of Queensland. And a fetal medicine specialist from Prince of Wales was interviewed about this, and he said that it was outrageous and that it represented an inequality in care which could be compared to a disparity in the quality of cancer care. That's from a female maternal medicine specialist, 2007, from an NJ article. Now, how did we get to that point where Down syndrome birth, instead of arousing our motivation to do the good, arouses our indignation? And that's what he was expressing. To look at that is my topic tonight, is to look at eugenics. How did we get here? And where are we going? There's sort of three parts to what I'm going to present tonight. Can anybody hear me? The first thing is, okay, what is eugenics? And I suppose now's the time to define it. It's a biomedical vision tending to the production of fine offspring. A biomedical vision tending to the production of fine offspring. But it stays a vision and nothing more unless the medical process picks it up and runs with it. Now, the medical process has actually already been doing that, and has carved its way into antenatal care. We call it prenatal testing. It's not the same as antenatal testing. It's not the same as antenatal care. And it's got nothing to do with saving or doing them good, with the quote from Thomas Fair. So how do these medical protocols, how do these processes come about? The third part of the talk we'll be looking at is just that. What have been and what are the enabling factors for eugenics? Now, before I go into those three honours, the biomedical vision, the medical process, which I will explain, and the enablers, I need to go back a bit briefly through the history just to set the scene with eugenics. It'll take me about 2 minutes if you can bear with me. Back in the 1920s, we had several countries with eugenic laws. At that time, it was long before fetal medicine, so it was compulsory sterilisation. In Switzerland and Sweden and Denmark, in the 1920s, and in 28 states of the USA, 28 states, there were compulsory sterilisation laws for things like hereditary feeble-mindedness and various other things. In 1933, the German Medical Association proposed a law, which then became enacted, which was for the compulsory sterilisation of hereditarily diseased persons. And there were lots of people who came under that, like epileptics, all sorts of things. So that was 1933, and it was proposed by the German Medical Association. In 1934, membership of the Nazi Party was comprised of interesting professional groups, but the professional group most strongly represented in Nazism was the medical profession. 44.8% of professionals in the Nazi Party were doctors. They were followed closely by the next professional group, which was lawyers, that actually numbered 25%, and never exceeded 25%. Of those doctors who joined the Nazi Party, most of them were recent graduates. There were people who graduated in that 10 years previously. The older doctors tended not to join. In 1947, after the Nuremberg medical trials had begun, the British Medical Journal published a bit of an analysis of what had gone wrong during in Germany during the lead up to the war and during the war. But the BMJ stated that medicine had been manipulated by the state, so it was a state problem. It had manipulated medicine. In 1996. Marking the 50th anniversary of the Nuremberg trials, the JAMA, which is the Journal of the American Medical Association, made the same mistake. They said that medicine had been manipulated by the state, and that was where things had gone wrong in Nazi Germany with eugenics and the atrocities that had occurred there. But the German Medical Association knew different, and they had a big convention in that year that marked the winter Nuremberg trials of 46. 50 years later in 96, and they called their conference in 1996 in Germany, they called it Medicine and Conscience. That was the name they gave it. And they had some sobering things to say to their peers. They said the removal of conscience from medicine creates an amoral medical force, which can then be sent in any direction. They also said that the separation of biological power from a moral sense would always be a danger to the profession. So that was their warning. However, it seemed to fall on deaf ears because, not very long after that, we have two boasts being made. One was in 2003 when Professor Sheffield from the Murdoch Children's Research Institute and himself a clinical geneticist bragged that Australia led the world in Down syndrome screening. But he also lamented that some of the states hadn't maximised their act. They hadn't got their act together. And he thought that there should be a national political response to this. In 2008, Denmark, one of the original countries, the eugenics, was bragging to the world that they had only delivered to life in that year 31 Down syndrome babies. In 2004, the College of OMG, which I belong to, and anybody who wants to practice obstetrics has to belong to that college or have the approval of that college, stated that prenatal testing should be offered to all pregnant women throughout Australia. That is now the standard of care, and it's called best medical practice. So what is Down syndrome? We do need to look at that before we go any further, briefly, because not everybody is. Just quickly, I'll always explain that Down syndrome is a chromosomal problem where the child has 47 instead of 46 chromosomes. And it's also known as trisomy 21 because they have an extra chromosome 21. It leaves the child with a very range of problems that may be mild, may be severe, but usually the most prominent one is learning difficulties. the literacy rate. Does anyone have a guess what the literacy rate is for Down syndrome? I guess it's okay. It's estimated at, well, not estimated, it's been studied at 41%, which is a lot more than most people realise. So 41% are quite educable, learn to read and write. The rest, they keep learning through their lives. So what they learn, what they take in, increases every year. They are also prone to other things like celiac disease, leukemia, thyroid disease. They have a higher incidence of dementia than the rest of us, but they don't all get it, of course. And sleep apnea, and a peculiar dislocation at the back of the neck that they can sometimes get. Now, because of these problems, for four decades, medicine has been trying to prevent the live births of Down syndrome by finding them. Initially, and as far as we know, the only cause of Down syndrome is advanced maternal age. So the older a woman is when she has her babies, the more likely she could be to be carrying a Down syndrome baby, and that does go up exponentially from about the age of 35. So it starts to increase. So therefore, from that age, medicine has been trying to extract fetal cells, because you need tissue, you need baby cells to diagnose it. Otherwise, you haven't got a definite diagnosis. So we've been zeroing on these older mums, but we were missing 70%. So we managed to catch 30% of Down syndrome that way, but then we'd miss 7 out of 10 babies. And that wasn't thought good enough. So medicine went looking for extra markers, apart from maternal age. And of course they found them. And we now have a system of testing that I'll go into, which looks at those markers and estimates the risk of that pregnancy to have Down syndrome. So prenatal testing, and this is the medical part, and we do have to just briefly go through it. Prenatal testing has three forms. The first one is the population search. That means everyone who's pregnant in Australia is offered this test. You have to actually opt out if you don't want to have it. It's an opt-out thing if you don't want it. And that test is aimed to give every pregnancy a number. And that number tells you what your risk is of having a Down syndrome baby. The second part of that population search is to then invasively test that baby to see if it has got Down syndrome or not. That's the first part, population search. The second part is direct diagnosis. So if there's a muscular dystrophy in the family or something like that, there's no screening test for that. So we go directly in and take cells either from the placenta or from the amniotic fluid and test that. That's a direct invasive test for the diagnosis. The third is pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. Now you've probably heard a lot about that recently in the news. That's the method that's been with us for a very long time now, which is part of IVF. So couples who are infertile, or couples who just want to know if their baby has a problem, or suspect the baby has a problem, can access this pre-implantation genetic diagnosis through IVF. So they artificially fertilise an egg, and then the egg or the small child will then currently reach day 5. And now on day 5, they're extracting about 2 cells, and then checking those cells for whatever abnormality they choose to check for. There are also some newer tests on the horizon, which we might just call advancement eugenics, and that's the Gattaca stuff. That's the stuff of Gattaca where you start picking attributes and phenotypes and IQ and that kind of thing from cellular diagnosis. Now, the population search is very poorly understood, so I'm going to spend just a minute just describing that. Now, in the population search, as I said, everyone in Australia goes through an assessment of the thickness at the back of baby's neck, the nuchal translucency thickness, plus the mother's blood test. And that all gets fed into a computer program, software, which calculates the risk that pregnancy has Down syndrome. And the whole idea of that is to isolate a target group. You can't diagnose Down syndrome. All it can say is, yep, you're more than, what's wrong? Your likelihood, thanks. Your likelihood is more than 1 in 300. And that's taken as the cutoff. So if you've got more than a 1 in 300 chance of delivering a baby with Down syndrome, that's considered to be enough risk to put you in the high risk group. So 1 in 20 mothers in Australia are allocated to the high risk group. 1 in 20, that's a huge percentage. So how many of those have Down syndrome? Well, according to RANSCOG, Royal Australian New Zealand College of Ology, in 2008, about 2 of every 20. So if you can see the tiny red line across the top, that's the actual incidence of Down syndrome. That's the target group in blue. It's not abnormal, it's just everybody above that 95th centile. No abnormality there necessarily. It's just there at the top end of that statistical range. So it's an arbitrary cutoff. And it's just chosen because you're trying to get the maximum Down's detection from the least false positive rate possible. So that's how we are. So 1 in 20 families will find themselves in this blue area, will find themselves recommended, offered, to have an invasive test. So what is the problem with that? Well, the problem with that is that the invasive test can be quite harmful to the child. RANSCOG figures say that the placental biopsy, which is known as a chorionic good assembly, up to a 1 in 33 chance of causing the death of the child. That's RANSCOG figures, not mine. And amniocentesis, which is taking out fluid rather than a bit of the placenta, has a death rate of up to 1 in 100 in the child. Of course, you don't know which children are going to be falling victim to that. So it's not a test anyone wants to do lightly. But that's the cost of the test. Now, a lot of mothers don't understand that, and a lot of specialists don't, and a lot of ordinary GPs don't understand that's the nature of the test. Mothers might think, when they're assigned to this group, that they have some additional, perhaps, biological problem that needs to be sorted out. They mostly don't. We do know that in this group that have screened positive, there is a slightly higher incidence of some other things like heart defects, talipes, which is an interned foot, some things like that will appear in this group with a greater preponderance, but they're not diagnosed with invasive testing anyway, and they're picked up at the 18-week, 20-week ultrasound. So that's the nature of prenatal screening. It's screening for the risk of Down syndrome, not for Down syndrome, for the risk of. The mortality rate from taking those biopsies and doing the amniocentesis is actually 6 to 8 times higher in a teaching hospital where you've got people training. Now you won't find that in the information brochures, but the studies have shown that where you've got registrars training, learning the procedure, mortality rate 6 to 8 times higher. Now, the other test I mentioned, the gene test for a pre-suspected thing, that's opt-in because there's no screening test. This one's opt-out, everyone has it. Muscular dystrophy, cystic fibrosis, those tests are opt-in. With the IVF test for pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, that's often promoted to mothers and families under the banner of preventing termination of pregnancy. So how do they get to that point? It's got to that point because pregnancy's been redefined. Pregnancy now starts on day 6 of the pregnancy. So where it used to start at conception, the International Federation of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, to which our body is a member, says, no, it starts on day 6. So therefore, we haven't terminated the conceptus, the child, because it's day 5 and not day 6. And that definition is also very handy for things like the morning after pill and it's very handy for the IVF industry in other regards. So we have Sydney IVF, Hunter IVF, and I'm sure it's equal things in Melbourne, putting out testimonials like this, where it says that one family was spared the heartbreaking decision of terminating a child because they were able to go through IVF, where they produced 8 babies, and they implanted 1, and they froze 2, and they discarded 5. So that's what IVF and PGD is selling. It's selling a product which doesn't use the word termination, but it certainly involves the wastage and the selection of some embryos over others. And it's being promoted that way, and a lot of people aren't understanding that the process that's involved. They don't create the perfect baby in the dish. What they do is eliminate all the others and just pick the best one that's left. Now, how are we, what are the enablers for this thing? We've talked about the process, so how is this able to come about? The first influential approach that people are up against when they're making these decisions is the idea of false compassion. There's this sense that Down syndrome children suffer and that parents will also suffer if they have to raise a Down syndrome child. But a lot of research has been done with Down syndrome children and asking them these sort of questions as they go into adolescence and adulthood. And in 2000 and 2007, two major studies done found that these people don't consider that there's suffering in their life. They're quite content and they're quite happy with the way their lives are. We also have a concept of despair that's coming in. In the Medical Journal of Australia in 2008, Lachlan de Crispini, who gets a fair bit of space in the MJO, said that in 30 years of obstetric practice, the diagnosis of fetal abnormality was one which affects couples as their worst nightmare. Now, I can only say that having done 27 years of obstetric practice, I haven't found that. The couple's worst nightmare is the worry that the child might die, that there'll be something that will happen before the birth or after the birth, and they will lose that child. That is the worst nightmare. I've only delivered one Down syndrome baby, and that happened to be actually on Good Friday. That person is now 21, and that person is very happy, and the family is very happy. It wasn't, by any means, the worst nightmare. But we have this negative picture of Down syndrome. So knowing the number of chromosomes is not going to tell us the quality of life. It's a very varied result for Down syndrome. Knowing the probability isn't going to tell us the severity. There's too many unknown factors there. But there's more to just false compassion and despair in the arguments that are coming up. We also have the economic argument, and that's what I want to just talk a bit about tonight. One of the main arguments put forward for screening for major congenital abnormalities, which also I picked up with the Down syndrome test, there's two others that I picked up with it, but I haven't mentioned them because they're pretty rare, about 1 in 5,000, whereas Down syndrome is about 1 in 800. But the Medical Journal of Australia is very aware of the economics. Do we get value for money from our Down syndrome babies? That's become the issue. Recent economic analyses, they said in March 2007, have shown that population-based screening, that's this one, probably represents value for money. When the costs of screening, it's hugely expensive, huge part of our medical budget, when the costs of screening are offset against the lifetime costs of caring for a person with Down syndrome, screening is less costly than no screening at all, regardless of what method we use. But it says also that for considerations, and I'm quoting from their journal, for considerations of national policy, cost-effective screening programs will be significantly compromised if the participation rate is low. So for every child that gets through the screening process, they're dragging down the cost-benefit ratio. The benefit-to-cost ratio has to be more than one. Otherwise, there's no point in doing it. For this Down syndrome population screening, the benefit-to-cost ratio is 1.57. So for this method to be effective, there has to be as much participation as possible. For a national policy, Down syndrome screening to be effective, the cost of the screening program to detect a certain number of cases has to be balanced against the cost of managing the missed or undetected cases in the population. So we have the economic influence, we have the despair, and if I can quote Anna Green Gables in this august body, Marilla Cuthbert, there's a point in that Marilla Cuthbert is walking down the stairs and someone says to her, she's Anne's doctor, mother. Someone says to her, have you ever despaired? And she's just walking down the stairs and she says, well, of course not. To despair is to turn your back on God. So it's interesting, we don't think of that these days, and we're not seeing despair as advice. We're not seeing it as being opposed to virtue. We're not seeing it as having anything particularly to do with God, but in fact it doesn't. It's turning its back on God. But the other enabling factors, I've got the economic argument, which is very strong, very much in the background, very much wanting universal screening, is the deterioration in medical standards. There's a fair bit of ignorance, so I alluded to before, but I'll just give you some examples. There's a lot of misinformation out there. Now, I'm just going to wave a few things around. The West Australian government gives out the most incorrect information on Down syndrome screening of any state. And funnily enough, they have the second highest level of screening. So what do they tell people? They tell people that the screening test will tell you whether Down syndrome is likely or unlikely. That's not true. It can't tell you that. It doesn't and it can't. It never could. It simply gives you a likelihood ratio. They also tell people that the amount of Down syndrome in that screen positive group, so 1 in 300 cut-off, is 5 to 6. That contradicted the evidence then as we know it. It does depend a bit on the maternal age group being studied, but in the population study, Rance Cole and the latest BMJ article of February 2011 say the number is 2. So it wildly exaggerates the density of Down syndrome in the screen positive group to encourage women to have a diagnostic test. And then, of course, once it's encouraging to have a diagnostic test, it says that the fetal mortality from the test is about half what it is for amniocentesis and a quarter of what it is for chorionic placenta. So it encourages people to have the test, and then it tells them a fraction of the hazard they could encounter. West Australia. Now, I did actually contact them about that, and they told me I was being picky. Now, I'm in the right place for this one. This is the federal government, Australian government initiative. Now it's called BioFacts. And it's only very short. It's a page and a half. But on the front page, it says about prenatal screening, when an abnormal result is obtained through either maternal serum screening or ultrasound, the mother is offered diagnostic testing. I'm sorry, but that is not an abnormal result. That is purely a statistical centile. Now, on the bottom in very tiny print, so tiny that I actually had to bring a magnifying glass so I could read it. It says, the Australian government agency, Biotechnology Australia, gives no warranties and makes no representations. Yeah, I know, but I can't hold both. I'm going to try. Okay, the Australian government agency, Biotechnology Australia, gives no warranties and makes no representations, whether express or implied, that the information provided is accurate. Now, these facts may not be facts. They're just called facts. To their credit, though, when I got in touch with them and said, look, you've got a mistake in your thing, a few months later, I followed the trail down to Melbourne University, actually, and a few months later, I got an email back saying, look, thanks, we're going to take it off the website. So we had a win. Then we have another Australian government one. Three mistakes. This is genetics at a glance. Yeah, thanks. This is called genetics at a glance, and it's designed to make life easier for GPs who don't know much genetics, so they can just take it out of their drawer and flick it open and read it to the patient. Thanks. It's got three big mistakes in it, which I've highlighted. Thanks. I don't need to make it quite the first one, it says that the prenatal screening test, purely statistical isolation of a target group, can detect some fetal abnormalities. No, it can't. And you might say, what about cardiac things? It still can't. It just tells you there's a risk of them. It could be there. It can't tell you what the outflow tract is. It's not a Doppler. It can't explain the actual cardiological problem. First mistake. Second mistake, at that time, you got the miscarriage rate wrong. Of course, it reduced it, didn't increase it. And you got it wrong for coronary bullet sampling too. So these quick grab things for GPs to pull out the drawer, three major errors. So on top of that, we've got misinformation, there's also a fair bit of ignorance. The study was done, women too actually, which showed that 47% of obstetricians and GP obstetricians did not know that 5% of the pregnant population was screened positive for Down syndrome. That's half of the maternal caregivers surveyed didn't know what the screen positive rate was, which is important information for parents. They want to know whether there's a problem or not, or whether they're just in a target group. They also found that there was a very small correlation between what doctors thought they knew and what they actually knew. So when they were asked how confident they were of the answers they gave, yes, they were very confident. Small correlation between actual knowledge and perceived knowledge. One third didn't know what the false positive rate was. And in one Australian tertiary level maternity hospital, less than 10% of healthcare professionals could provide accurate information about prenatal screening tests. Less than 10%, we had single figures, who could provide accurate information about the prenatal screening test. And yet it's recommended to all mothers. And they're being scared into having invasive testing done. Now, we have a problem here because we have issues of encouraging personal choice, which is what doctors are meant to do. We're meant to encourage the mother to make a personal choice about this and the father, the family. But at the same time, we've got a public health screening program, which is oriented towards maximum pickup, to get that cost-benefit ratio to stay above one, otherwise the whole thing goes belly up. So we've got different goals now being steered pretty much in the same direction by a combination of misinformation, ignorance, a lot of emotional talk, despair, and a lot of other sorts of more subtle sort of manipulation. For example, at the start of the prenatal screening program, which began to be rolled out in 2000, this was the pamphlet that first promoted it in our area where I live. And they've gone for the thoughtful, wise, genteel, soft and kind look, as if these are the people who are likely to be taking up this offer of checking their baby for Down syndrome. Wouldn't you want to be like her? Wouldn't you want to be thoughtful, kind, wise, gentle? That was the image that the industry's chosen. It's duplicated in lots of pamphlets. I'm sure someone's got a PhD on working out that that was probably the most effective way of putting the message across. But at the same time in New South Wales, this pamphlet came out. Prenatal diagnosis. That's got nothing to do with antenatal care. Well, it shouldn't have. Prenatal diagnosis. Now, there's a pregnant mother, and stamped across her abdomen are the words, the importance of checking your baby's health before birth. So it's being promoted strongly as something important that any mother who's wanting the best for a child will do this, will go with this. We'll keep that cost-benefit ratio well above one. So there's a lot of manipulation afoot, and there's a lot of ignorance, and there's a lot of disintegration of medical oaths. Now, as prenatal testing has ramped up since 2000, when it first came in, and then more since 2004, when it became obstetric policy, to which we're all sort of accountable, when those things ramped up and came in, medical oaths began to deteriorate. Now, if you just, sometimes you can actually go onto a website and look at a university's medical oath. But in Prince of Wales, about the same time as screening was coming in, the medical students, because they write their own every year, they don't have the Hippocratic Oath anymore, that went out even before my time. They write their own. And the whole idea is that somebody mentors the group and the sort of dominant people in the group and I suppose the dominant personality in the group takes over the writing of the oath. And we end up with some very strange things. Now, around that time, one of the comments that appeared was, I believe prejudice has no place in medicine. It's one of the tenets in the graduating oath from Prince of Wales Hospital. Now, it sounds okay, it doesn't sound too bad. I believe prejudice has no place in medicine. But about the same time, FIGO, that Federation of International Gynecologists and Obstetricians, were redefining pregnancy as starting on day six. About that time, the morning after pill was coming out. Some GPs were saying, because it can cause abortion, it doesn't always, but because it can, they weren't happy about prescribing it. So the College of GPs spokesperson came out and said, no, don't they understand? Pregnancy doesn't start on day one or day two. It doesn't start till day six. So these doctors are prejudiced. They haven't read the information, not interested in finding out. They're just too prejudiced to find out that pregnancy now starts on day six. So even lines in an oath that can sound fairly benign and banal can actually have quite a sinister implication. So oaths have been deteriorating, they've been severed, completely severed from Hippocratic principles, just in step with us severing our solidarity with humanity. The two are happening concordantly. So we have slogans, we have parents not knowing which way is up, we have doctors not knowing which way is up, but still running with this thing. But for a mother to undertake, and a family, a father to undertake an invasive test, which is still the gold standard, and even though there's new developments, which I'll briefly mention, that is the current process. She has to come to the point of believing and accepting that the death of her child would be preferable to the birth of a Down syndrome child, because sometimes the risk of the procedure killing the child will actually be greater than the risk of Down syndrome. So she has to, in her mind, accept the hazard rate as worth it to undertake the testing. And that's one of the sad features of where we've come to with eugenics. So we've got misinformation, we've got informed choice non-existent, we've got pressure, we've got concealment of the cost-benefit ratio, negative value assigned to children with Down syndrome and adults. We've got covert values against disability, and particularly against medical and mental retardation. So how can we have informed choice? And we're being groomed to accept all these eugenic principles, even where parents can no longer intercede for their child. They don't feel confident to do that. In December, and these things are going to come into sharper focus now, because in December last year, they were able to map the fetal genome from DNA bits of pieces in the mother's blood. There's nothing wrong with information. Information is morally neutral. And in a sense, prenatal screening is morally neutral too. You have to ask the question, why are we doing it? And what are we going to do with the knowledge when we've got it? And how are we getting it? Does it cause a hazard to the child? So screening itself doesn't cause a hazard. It's the next step. It's that biopsy of the placenta or the amniotic fluid extraction that causes the hazard. And at that point, the moral neutrality ceases. Once you expose a child to a disproportionate risk of harm for one's own comfort or for society's comfort or for any economic rationale, you've crossed the line from moral neutrality into an area of evil. With the knowledge that we have of the fetal genome that can now be put together from fragments in the mother's blood, all this is going to come into much sharper focus. The BMJ in February, British Medical Journal, in February this year, published a study of 1,000 women where they've been able to actually extract fetal DNA to check for Down syndrome. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but what do you then do with that information? And it doesn't hurt anybody extracting it, but what's the purpose? It costs thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars at the moment to be doing that, so are they really planning not to terminate once they diagnose these babies? We have families who are trying to carve their way out of these protocols. They haven't got the words. A lot of them don't have the courage, they don't understand the process, but they're trying to fight their way out. And in some ways, we can have an enormous effect by just talking about this and bringing it to light. But we need to think about finding the words and giving these families the confidence and the courage to rise above all this. The hardest thing, sometimes when we're counselling people, they'll turn around and say at the end of it all, look, would it be so terrible if I had a Down syndrome child? And that's because they've received all these messages that they'll be failing the expectations of their friends and family and other onlookers in the community. So in closing, I'll just remind you of the warning of the German Medical Association to their peers, that medicine without a conscience can be sent in any direction. And I will put it to you that I think we've already headed down this path with very little debate.
That was Dr. Deirdre Little with Embryo Quality Checks, Creating the Children We Want. Guinness and God is held once a month at King O'Malley's Pub in Canberra. For more, visit catholiclife.org.au or cradio.org.au.